All right, well, when I asked Dad if I could teach chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes, he totally thought that because we were kind of going at this rapid pace that we were going to get through a whole chapter in one day. And then I would just kind of with my typical fashion, I pretty much ensured that we're going to be in here at least 2 weeks in chapter 3. I'm going to try to not go for an hour. We'll see how it goes. Yeah, that was much to Dad's chagrin. But it wasn't intentional. I truly just think that the passage that we have today, I really think that it's very deep, and I think that it's going to be very good for us. You're probably going to experience some frustration with it. I know that I did, but it's a good frustration. It's a frustration that leads to growth. It's a very good passage. The truth that we're looking at here, it's really an awesome thing. And I'm going to be speaking mainly to believers today, but for anyone that's listening that's not saved over audio or whatever it might be, I think that this passage has even huge application to them as well. So I think that for pretty much everyone, this passage has a lot of truth to it. This book, Ecclesiastes, it's a depressing book at times, and that's just the truth. It's Solomon's very blunt about some things, and it's kind of a edged book, so to speak. But, in our passage today, there's going to be some of that. There's going to be a little bit of that, and it's going to be a little bit of a hard pill to swallow. It definitely will be. But once we have swallowed that pill, it'll be so sweet. I can promise you that. It'll be very, very sweet. God has taught me a lot about life. He's taught me a lot about the events that take place within life, how we're made, and ultimately how God is so sovereign. That's really what this passage is about, and you'll see that as we go along, but just about how he's so sovereign, so powerful, him being eternal and us being absolutely meaningless without him. He gives meaning to our life, and that's really what this passage is about. And I don't want to take too much time here to talk about this. I don't want to take up too much time, but I would like to be very personal with you guys for a moment. One of the reasons I was elated to teach Ecclesiastes a little bit anyway, this is actually my favorite Old Testament book. It's a deeply personal and intense book for me. And the reason being is, and I'm just being honest, I sometimes struggle with purposelessness. It's not a clinical depression kind of thing. I'm fine. But it's just not something that I parade around. It's not something that I really talk about too much. But I often find myself identifying with Solomon quite a bit. I'm certainly not wise and intelligent like him. I'm not a rich. I'm not a king, although sometimes I like to pretend that I am. But I get where he's coming from when he asks that question, what's the point? What's the point? Last week, as we saw, Solomon concluded, there's really no point aside from life with God. And we're going to talk more about that soon as we go along. But what I'm trying to convey here, maybe a little bit clumsily, is that I need this book and the truth probably more than anybody in this room. I would be in a bad place if it weren't for Solomon and Ecclesiastes. And all that said, and the reason I kind of say that I'm leading up to this, nothing I say today is in a pretentious or arrogant fashion. I'm trying to convey that. I don't want to convey that. There will be some stinging moments. There definitely will be, but it's definitely for me first and foremost. And I just want to let you guys know that I'm going to try and teach this as gently as I possibly can. So, all right, with that, turn to Isaiah 46, not Ecclesiastes. Gotcha good, didn't I? Turn to Isaiah, trust me on this one. You see, in order to kind of understand our passage today in Ecclesiastes, you really have to, there's some things that we have to kind of orient ourselves to. You cannot divorce it from the context in which we find it in Ecclesiastes. Now, Solomon has been examining life, and then he started looking at God in life. And if you take that away from our passage, the meaning of our passage in Ecclesiastes 3, that one is going to be a little bit skewed. So, you know, last week, Solomon concludes, as we kind of talked about a second ago, that life is meaningless without God. It's pointless. Chapter 2, verses 24 through 26 read, and this is from the NASB. I think it reads a little bit more clear. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he is given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he might give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after wind. Now, we see there that Solomon understands that God is sovereign, that God dispenses these things to whom he pleases. You know, he gives enjoyment, he gives pleasure, he gives knowledge. He does what he pleases. He gives it to who he wants. Solomon understands that life with God means something because all of those concepts come from somewhere. They come from someone. It's not just in a vacuum. It's from a sovereign God. And that's what Solomon kind of concluded last week. And this is kind of the key to understanding the passage today, but it's a little bit easy to miss. God is sovereign. I know that seems kind of simple, but that's what Solomon's dealing with right now, that God is sovereign. And our passage today must be read in the light of what it means for God, or what it means to be sovereign, what it means for God to be sovereign. We have to read it in that light, that God is king over everything. Now, to help us understand kind of what Solomon's trying to tell us today about God being sovereign and about the frustrations in our life and things like that, it would do us well to read a passage that just kind of screams what it means for God to be sovereign. And that's why we're here in Isaiah, or at least you guys are. I'm not. Okay, there we go. So Isaiah 46, start in verse 5. We're going to read down to verse 11. To whom will ye liken me, and make me equal, and compare me, that we may be like? They lavish gold out of the bag, and weigh silver in the balance, and hire a goldsmith, and he maketh it a god. They fall down, yea, they worship. They bear him upon the shoulder, they carry him, and set him in his place, and he standeth. From his place shall he not remove, yea, one shall cry unto him, yet he cannot answer, nor save him out of his trouble. Remember this, and show yourselves men. Bring it again to mind, O ye transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. Yea, I have spoken, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it. Do you see what I mean a little bit more? There is none like God. There is nobody like God. He declares the end from the beginning. Not only does he know it, but he declares it. And what does that mean? It means he literally controls every single thing. Every little thing. Nothing happens that God does not will. Nothing. And, you know, what does it mean to be sovereign? Well, read the second half of verse 10. You know, it says over here in verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will do all my pleasure. I will do all my pleasure. What does it mean? It means he does whatever he wants because he's God. That's what it means. He can do whatever he wants, whatever's in his pleasure, all of it. And, you know, in context, God's kind of talking about Cyrus. I apparently have a bulletin up here I didn't mean to grab. God's talking about Cyrus in verse 11, and there's other things that go along with that, but just we're concerned with how he talks about it. Just look at verse 11 again. He says, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass, I have purposed it, I will also do it. You know, I mean, catch that thing at the end. He did it. I mean, he did it. Being sovereign as God means you have total control over everything. That's what it means. Not a blip or a second will ever catch God by surprise, because not a blip or a second will ever pass that he didn't want to pass in the first place. it's not just events either, it's all of creation. Psalm 139 is a very familiar psalm, the fearfully and wonderfully made psalm. It's not just life events, it's people, it's us, it's your biochemical makeup, it's your personality. Everything in creation is determined by God. He controls it all. He declares the end from the beginning. That's what it means to be sovereign. He does whatever he wants. So, all that aside, like we said, every bit of creation, it's under God's thumb. He's on his throne, and all of creation is subject to his sovereignty, to his express will. Now, he intimately knows and he fashions his creation. That's extremely important as well. He intimately knows and he fashions his creation. Now, he's not a static being that just kind of kicked the ball and got it rolling and then he just left his create. He's not like that. We know that. He's not like that. He's involved with this world and he's sovereignly controlling everything that he wants to come to pass. Day by day, moment by moment, second by second, to the most minute millisecond, nanosecond that you can think of. And this is the realization that Solomon, back in Ecclesiastes, is getting to. This is where he's coming to. And it's that God has created man and world, and the creation is meaningless. It's purposeless. Life is purposeless without its sovereign creator. That's what Solomon is coming to. So in the passage today, go ahead and turn over to Ecclesiastes 3 now. In the passage that we have today, Solomon is going to say, essentially, that life has meaning with God, yes, but there is more to it than that. There's more to it than just that blanket statement. It goes a lot deeper than that. To believe in God, but to divorce him from the events in our life and the world around us and all of creation will just lead us to a very similar state that the person who doesn't have any fellowship with God pretty much finds themselves in. Only when we read Solomon's words today in light of God's sovereignty do we find purpose and meaning in our life. And that's why we went to Isaiah first to look at this. That's what we're going to see. So go ahead and, like I said, turn over to Ecclesiastes. We'll see what I'm talking about as we go along here. As we mentioned, we concluded that Solomon understood at the end of chapter 2 that God is the sovereign dispenser of all things. Or all those things that he mentioned. Now that our thoughts are kind of oriented around the sovereignty of God, I suppose, we're going to read chapter 3 here. Chapter 3 is kind of in a roundabout way, it's sort of an expansion of chapter 2. Like we said, you know, Solomon's conclusions and his thoughts in chapter 2, they're kind of leading up to what we're doing today. So it's kind of almost if Solomon's saying, well, if God is sovereign over all that stuff, and that's what gives all that meaning, then chapter 3. That's kind of how this is going. So we're going to read all the way down to verse 15 first, and then we're going to back up and comment, because I think it's important to read all of what he's saying in kind of a block. This is a book of wisdom, so sometimes it's better to read kind of blocks and everything. So let's go ahead and start in verse 1 down to 15. To everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under the heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away. A time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their hearts so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Also, that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, it is the gift of good. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nothing or it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. and God requireth that which is past. Okay. So, in light of what we've kind of gone over, there's a decent chance you probably see where this is kind of headed. This text, of course, is the famous, there's a time for blank passage. This is the one the birds made famous through popular culture, or so I'm told. That was like 60 years ago. Some of you guys are getting pretty old. Anyway, my point being, you've probably heard of this passage in some form or fashion. I can recall my grandmother. I won't tell you which one, but she has three sons, and her name is... Oh, never mind. But anyway, I can recall her saying things like, you know, Austin Fisher, there's a time to keep silent, and things like that, trying to get me to shut up. and to some degree, you know, I suppose that's not a completely wrong usage of this passage, but there's far more to it than just being a passage about there being different times for us to do things. Because, you know, if that's all this passage is, if that's all it is, then we are hopelessly locked in a monotonous cycle of life that more or less, as we kind of mentioned, leads to us to conclude that pretty much everything, like the despair that Solomon found in chapter 2, is found here in the majority of chapter 2. He ends on a good note, but... this passage, as we go along, you'll see, I mean, it's really about God. It's about God. And we're in this passage, don't worry, but it's really mainly about him. And you'll see how that plays out. You'll see as we kind of go along here. So let's back up to verse 1 here. Verse 1. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. Okay. Now, this is kind of a heading of sorts, right? This is sort of a heading of the list that we read below. I think it's a little bit easy to miss the importance of this heading, though. This is going to sound a little bit strange, but just follow what I'm saying. This list, it's the list following this verse. It's talking about things. I know that sounds kind of stupid, but... It's not really talking about time. It says there's a time for this and a time for that, but it's talking about actions and life events and things that happen in the world. As the heading kind of says, it says that, you know, there's a time for all these things to take place. So it's really talking about things. In other words, these things don't just happen. They don't just happen whimsically. This is not a list of things that just happen. And that's the point here. It's not a list of things that just happen. These purposes, these things, they're from God himself. So let's read verses 2 down to verse 8. We have a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather them, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. That is really hard to say. All right, so... What are these things? Well, as we said, they're things that happen in life. This is life. It's what it is. It's life. It's things that happen in life, and that's kind of what they are. And I'm inclined to think that Solomon's really not being exhaustive here. He's just trying to get across that everything under heaven, every purpose has a time and a season, right? That's kind of what he's getting at. Everything that happens has a time and a season. That's what he's getting at. Now, if we're going to say, or if there is to be any meaning to life and the things which occur into it, then everything in them must be meaningfully placed. Like, if it's all just a bunch of things that happen, then there's no meaning in them. So they have to be, the things that happen to us, the things that are, this list, it has to be meaningfully placed for there to be purpose in it. Does that make sense? Are you following? Without God, there wouldn't be anything to place them in their time. If there was no God, then they're just a bunch of things that happen. There's no meaning to be found in that. Now, think about that for a moment. Mull that over in your head for a second, okay? It's not something to gloss over, because if we look at this list again, a time to die, a time to kill, a time to weep, a time to mourn, a time for war. You get the picture, right? Solomon is telling us that, yes, everything under heaven, even the really bad stuff, even the negative things in our life, everything, even the bad stuff about ourselves, it's all ordained and sovereignly controlled and sent from who? God. That is the only way that these things have any meaning in them whatsoever. Because if they're not from God, what are they? They're just things that happen. That's all they are. God sets the time for us to mourn. God wills for us to weep sometimes. God decides that we should go to war every now and then. And you know, even the things that Satan sends us are only things permitted by God. You can check Job 1 for that. And Satan wasn't allowed to touch Job unless God said, hey, you're allowed to. So, all of those things come from God. And on the flip side, I suppose, you know, he decides when it's time for us to smile. He decides when we should laugh and dance. He decides when the time it is that we should gather stones. Everything as God has said about himself in Isaiah is declared from the end to the beginning or the beginning to the end. All your movements, all your thoughts, all the world is declared by God. All of it. Everything has its time, but God is the clockmaker. Right? And that, folks, is what this passage is really about. Do you see what I mean? This passage is not about just us. This is about God. This is about him being sovereign. That's what this passage is about. This is about Solomon trying to tell us just how intimately involved God is with his world, with his creation, with you, with me, with everything. But I suppose this is the question. It's an understandable question, really. Why would he want us to weep? Why would God want us to mourn? Why would he want us to go to war? Why would he want that? Why would God will for those things to happen? And Solomon gives us the answer, but you're going to have to hang on a minute because he gets to it after a couple more verses. So hang on to that and tuck that in the back of your head. We'll get back to it in a moment. Let's return for a moment to just the fact that God does will these things, and he ultimately sends what he wants. He sends what he wants. Let's return to that fact for a minute. He sends all things under heaven. Now, verse 9, like I said, we'll come back to all this stuff. Just tuck it away for a second. Verse 9 kind of deals with what we might think of as Solomon's way of looking at the world or the list above in the context of there being no purpose or meaning behind them, there being no God that sends those things. Now, he knows that there is meaning behind them, so he's kind of rhetorically implying here that if God did not sovereignly ordain all those things, then we have verse 9, and it says, what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? Okay? The labor there kind of speaks of earthly pursuits in general, not necessarily even just like work, but he's really what he's saying is, what do you have to gain? What are you gaining here? The life, what's the point? And, I mean, is there any point and all the things that happen? You don't get a single thing out of it if God didn't send it. If it's just stuff that happens, you don't get anything out of it. What profit do you have? You build up and you go through laugh, you cry, and then you live, and eventually, what? You die. That's it. It's unfulfilling in every sense of the word if God didn't send all those things. And people pretend to be satisfied with their lives, but deep down, they can't be because there's ultimately no gain, according to Solomon. There's ultimately nothing to gain. What do you get from the above list when those life aspects mean nothing? Well, you get nothing. And that's why so many people are so unhappy. They don't believe that God controls their lives and in the world around them, much less believe in his son. So when they look forward, or rather they look forward to their favorite TV show, they look forward to the weekend, I guess, or Friday, or, I don't know, Alabama football, something. And they look for something to escape in, to hide from the truth, and eventually those things fade. They're temporary. They're left with just that miserable and mundane cycle that to them means nothing. That's all. No wonder our coworkers are miserable. No wonder the people around us are unfulfilled. Because as Solomon already knows and has implied, this list, it's got to be from God. Those people don't believe that, though. So, you know, if it's not from God, then in honesty, what are we doing here? If God doesn't control everything in our lives, what are we doing? No wonder they're like that. But hold on, tuck that in the back of your head. We're going to come back to that too. That was loud. We're going to return to this thought even more too. These are building up to something, I promise. Tuck that away. For right now, Solomon knows that this list is from God. He knows that it's from God. And look at what he says next in verse 10. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. Now this is what is commonly referred to as the God-given task. In modern translations, it'll say, I have seen the task, or the God-given task. Travail just means task. Now, note please that this task is God-given. God gave this travail to the sons of men. God gave it. It's the task mentioned in chapter 1 when Solomon says, you know, the task is for men, the burden for men is to understand and to seek wisdom and to live life, to understand life and its purpose. That's the burdensome task, but it's God-given. It's God-given. And, of course, then, what are we to understand here? What is Solomon getting at? Well, let's read the first part of the next verse, and this is where everything's coming to a head. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. I want you to read that a couple times. Underline it if you're an underliner. Beautiful. The clockmaker has made everything beautiful in its time. Beautiful refers to fitting or appropriate. Some translations will say God has made everything appropriate in its time. This kind of echoes Genesis, and God saw that it was good. In Genesis, of course, we know there was a fall that happened, right? And the curse of sin plagued the world, and hence the reason we have most of those negatives on that list. You know, a time to die, a time to kill, a time for war. But he wills them. And why does he do that? This is why. Because in this sin-cursed, fallen world, he's making everything beautiful, good, appropriate, right, in its own time, in his time. All the events that happen to you, all the pieces of you that exist, all the everything, he's ordained every last bit of it to make it beautiful in his time. I was listening to a sermon on this passage, and something he did was he went through this list and he chose the things that he would want to keep. I mean, nobody wants to choose a time to die or things like that, right? But then he said, but God loves me way too much to let me have my way. It's a sobering thought, but it's true, where he was coming from with it. If we could have our way in a fallen world, we'd never choose the bad. We'd always want something good, and we'd become something entirely different than what God would want us to be. And he knows what we ought to be better than we ever could. And quite frankly, if I never had any of this bad stuff in my life, I'd probably turn out to be a spoiled brat that never looked to God for anything. As he said in Isaiah, and as you can see now, that's why we turn there first. Who can you liken unto God? Who is there like God Almighty that knows us so well, that knows how to fashion life better than, anyone? He is creator that sovereignly fashioned you, the nations, earth, the universe, simply by saying, let there be. Let there be. And there are no accidents with him either. You know, if there's a time to be born, he made it so. It's because he decided it's time for that person to be born. You are not here by accident. No person is ever here by accident. You're fearfully and wonderfully and purposefully made. But if it's also your time to die, it's because, yes, he's making something beautiful out of that in his own time. And you might say, okay, well, what about this awful thing in my life? Yeah, even that. even that. When we get like that, it's because we're only looking at it from the human side of things. It's kind of like trying to look at this beautiful and marvelous painting or this mural, but you can only see one tiny little stroke. That's all you can see because we're so focused on that thing. But if we back away and we look at this and we just see that he's making everything beautiful, not in my time, not in yours, not in human time, in his time. Every mishap in our lives is not a mishap. No mishap is ever actually a mishap. There's never a fluke in our lives. Nothing like that is ever a fluke. It's perfectly ordained by sovereign God. Even when we sin, though we ought not to, he allows us to do it for a reason. If it wasn't going to be something that he willed ultimately, he would have stopped us. Now, of course, you should not sin. That's something I'm not going to get into all that, the nuances of that. It does get a little bit complicated. But even then, there's a reason for it. It's perhaps that we might learn to not do that or something to that effect. But there is a time and a season for every little thing under heaven, every single little thing. And the clockmaker decides when it's time for those things to take place. And I know that's not the easiest thing to swallow. But it's the only thing that makes any sense out of any of this stuff. It's the only thing that does. It really is. You may not be able to see the purpose behind everything, but maybe you're not supposed to. Maybe your grandchild 50 years down the road is supposed to see it. Or maybe you're not supposed to see it till you die and go to heaven. He's got everything under control, though. Nothing will ever surprise him, because nothing ever occurs that wasn't first purposed by him and for his express glory. So, is there a lesson here? Yeah, and there'll be a couple more too. I know we're kind of cutting close, but first here, the first thing I want to summarize and say, let go. Let go. It's hard to swallow, and I know that, but you know, it's that our Father, our Lord, yes, Jesus Christ himself, wills for bad things to happen. But it's beautiful, and it's time, in his time. It's beautiful. It really is. He's got us. If it wasn't supposed to happen, he would have never purposed it. He's declared the end from the beginning, right? Right? He's sovereign. We're just one little paint stroke in this beautiful, beautiful painting. It's a masterful creation that maybe one day in our glorified bodies we'll be able to understand, to look at. But right now, trust him. Trust the God who made everything, who made time and everything that occurs in it. He's making something beautiful. He is. He's making you beautiful. And that's why sometimes it's time to cry. And that's why sometimes it's time to mourn. Because one day that anguish will become beauty. It will. But only in his time. Only in his time. Now, Solomon's not quite finished. He's going to teach us a little bit more about this trust in God and sovereign God. So I want to read the next phrase in verse 11. Also, he hath set the world in their heart. Stop there. Now, very quickly, I need to mention something here, and it's that the word there that says world means eternity. It's not talking about sin or fleshliness, not like he has set the sin in their hearts. It's not talking about that. The word there refers to eternity. In Hebrew, this word is speaking of a duration of time. And it's just one of those words that you have to update. The ASV, NASV, ESV, and NKJV all say eternity. It's just kind of an outdated word, but it's referring to eternity there. So this is going to change the meaning of the verse a little bit, and I understand that. We'll come back to this translation thing in just a second, because there's some things that kind of persist with this. But for now, just know that we should read this phrase, also he hath set eternity in their heart. He hath set eternity in their heart. And you'll see how this fits a little bit better contextually with the last phrase as well as we go along. So we've established that God sovereignly controls everything. We know that he does it because he's making something beautiful in his own time. We know that. However, how do we come to know that, and why is it important to know that? Well, it's because when God created us, he created us in the divine image. He put eternity in our hearts. And you see, the only thing that's eternal besides our souls, right, is God. That's it. So this circles back to the discussion that we had about the no profit or gain from the labor here on earth. The only thing that can possibly satisfy our souls is God. That's the only thing. That's it. Apart from God, the list of life events, the list of life here, it's completely meaningless. You know, just, I mean, without God, it's just looking forward to the next temporarily positive thing before you slump back into the spiritual depression. All men and women have eternity in their hearts. That's, I mean, there's this insatiable curiosity in our hearts that screams to, and it cries to search for God. This is the Romans 2 of the Old Testament, that man and women are without excuse, right? This is the Romans 2 of the Old Testament. Men and women have that truth inside of them, but they suppress that in unrighteousness. And when we do that, this list of life, it becomes completely and wholly unsatisfying. Really, you know, there's a second lesson here to be found, and it's that we should trust God because he's making everything beautiful in his own time, but also it's the only thing that will actually satisfy your soul, right? It's the only thing that's going to make sense out of all this stuff. And hopefully you can see as well how this makes a little bit more sense, the translation, the word eternity there. But this is, I mean, if our inherent eternity that's in within all of us and our souls, if it's suppressed by sin, unrighteousness, our soul will suffer and we will never, ever be fully content. There's no way we possibly can. Romans essentially saying that outside of God, everything that occurs in life will be shrouded in meaninglessness, despair, and purposelessness because it all ends. It's all temporary. It all ends. And I might mention that, you know, only God is eternal, right? We said that. Only God is eternal, and only when one sees that he's purposed everything for his eternal plan do we find meaning, contentment. And I should also mention that Christians are not impervious to slinking into kind of this thought that sometimes unbelievers are kind of at, you know, we shouldn't, but we do. I'm extremely prone to forgetting my eternity. I'm extremely prone to that. I'm extremely prone to forgetting about God's eternal plan, and that's probably what often probes me to say, what's the point? This is extremely important. It's so, so, so important to remember that God is not just making you and everything beautiful, but it's all purposed for an eternal plan that your eternal soul cries out for. That's what it means to begin understanding life. But before you think you have it all figured out, let's see what he says next. I'm trying to hurry here. All right, so the end of verse 11. So that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Okay, I want to read this from the ESV and talk again in a second about this translation. I'll try to hurry here. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot figure out what God has done from the beginning to the end. As you may notice, the last phrase kind of differs from what's in the KJVs, plus the word eternity is there. It says, yet so, and that's a little more literal, but still kind of meh. I'm gonna spare you the details of the translation and everything with this sentence, but what you need to know is that the Hebrew in this sentence is extremely obscure. It's very difficult to translate. Almost every commentator pretty much skirts by this phrase, this verse, a little bit, because it's so hard to translate this last sentence. Whether you're reading in whatever version it is, this phrase is confusing. But the best way that I have found to give this to you guys is kind of as follows. Well, God has put an awareness of eternity in our hearts. He has done so in such a way that makes it impossible for us to know everything that God does. That's kind of the best understanding we probably have of this verse. And I suppose that to some degree, this might refer to the fact that we are finite and God is infinite. We cannot logically know all that God does because he's eternal and we're not. In the sense of infinity. We go on, we're eternal, we just spoke about that, but he's eternal in the infinite sense. But I suppose that's pretty aggravating because it's aggravating to me at least. I like to know things. I'm a know-it-all. Sarah and Bethany will tell you about that. But aside from that, it kind of feels like hitting an intellectual wall. You know, we have all this stuff, and then Solomon says, but you can't know everything. You can't know everything God does because he's made you in such a way that you can't. You're not infinite like him. So we hit this wall, and it's kind of like, what gives, right? But he's not really saying this in a negative sense. I listened to a sermon on this passage, another one. And when the man arrived to this sentence, he didn't spend a whole lot of time on it like everyone else. They kind of skirt by it. But he said that his interpretation was that mystery is a prerequisite for faith. And thus, that's why we're made to not know everything, I suppose, and everything that God's. And at first, I kind of felt like he had skirted by it, maybe taken the easy way out. But I've actually kind of adopted this view of this is kind of actually what Solomon's saying here. And this is kind of almost a culmination point of everything that he's been leading up to. And this is what I've been trying to get to here. Our faith should never be blind. Should not be blind. But our faith will never be all-knowing. It can't be. Can't be. Even Adam and Eve in pre-fall time could not have possibly known the world of trouble they were getting into when they bit into that fruit. They didn't know because they couldn't know everything. They were not created to know everything, even before the fall. We aren't God. We're not infinite. We're eternal in the sense that we continue on forever, but we're not infinite like God. Solomon here is telling us to have faith. Though we cannot possibly comprehend everything that our Creator Clockmaker does, have faith that he's making everything beautiful in his own time and know that having faith in him is the solution to our awareness of eternity. That's what Solomon's saying here. Having faith is the fulfillment. It's the answer, and it is the trusting in the sovereignty of God. That's what it is. Because that incomprehensible sovereignty, when we finally bow and submit to it, look at how we can begin to view things. 12 and 13, really quick. I know that there is no good in them. That means there's nothing better for them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, it is the gift of God. It is the gift of God. These verses are positives and negatives. Rejoicing and toiling, they're both the gift of God. They're both the gift of God. When one trusts, when one has faith that eternal God is purposing the events in their life for something marvelous and beautiful, suddenly life becomes a gift. Life becomes a gift. The perspective changes, and everything finally has meaning. Everything finally has purpose. You know, I work at Hobby Lobby, and my title is stockman, so you might think that I stock shelves, and you'd be 30% right. Most of the time, I scrub toilets. That's what I do. I sweep, and I get garbage. I'm a little bit over it. But even that is a gift from God, according to this, because even there, it's a gift from God that I'm able to show a Christ-like attitude there, that I'm able to show a good work ethic, that I'm allowed to have conversations with people about God. Everything there is actually a gift from God, even though I kind of am over the job itself. It's a gift from God. And it doesn't mean I have to stay there forever. It doesn't mean you have to stay in the same position your entire life necessarily. If God wills that you go somewhere else, then of course you have that, and that's a gift from God. But while you're there, and while he wills for you to be there, while he wills for this thing to happen to you, whatever it might be, it's a gift of God. It is a gift. You know, my rejoicing is also a gift from God, not just my labor and my toil. It's, you know, I rejoice in standing before you and keeping you here way past the hour. And I rejoice in, you know, God letting us go to the beach in a week and things like that. I rejoice in these things because why? They're all a gift from God. It's even the worst experiences in my life, in our life, they're all the gift of God. When we respond to life, we're responding to God. These things aren't meaningless. They have meaning. They're given by someone. There's a purpose behind them. It's not just, oh, great, this thing happened. It's, no, God had this happen, so how should I respond to it? It's a gift of God. He ordained it, and he's giving it to us. And it's not the most emotionally satisfying thing, no, but I can promise you that this truth is spiritually satisfying. You know, I know that no matter how meaningless or pointless or whatever mundane life may feel at times, whether that be school or work or whatever catastrophe occurs in my life or whatever it is, it's not all for naught. It's purposeful. It's meaningful. It's a gift. It's a gift from God. And learning to submit to the all-sovereign God is hard. It's bitter. But once you bow down, it's so sweet. It really is. And Solomon knows now. He knows this now. Look at the last two verses here. I'm sorry. We're finishing up. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it, and God doeth it, that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been, and God requireth that which is past. Verse 15 probably is better read, that which is has already been, and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what is passed by. But that aside, Solomon knows that he will never add or take anything away from God's eternal plan, his sovereign plan. God is constructing something so big that our pathetic little minds, there's no way we're going to be able to even comprehend it. But that's okay. That's a matter of fact, that's good. That's the way it's to be. That's the way that God has put us. That's good. Accepting our place, as Solomon is beginning to do, and knowing that we're not in control, trusting in sovereign God to make everything in our lives beautiful for his eternal purpose, this is wisdom. This is hard wisdom. This is understanding. And when God decrees that something should be and he does it, we should healthily fear him and his plan. And not, and I mean that not in the sense of respect. I mean, be afraid. Fear his plan. Fear what he is planning. Submit in the most holy sense and revere and bow to it. His plan is unchanging, and it's the same as it was before you or I were around, before the world was around. So, as we kind of draw to a conclusion here, a quick word to the saved that are listening. This book, though it's depressing at times, shows a happy perspective here at the end of this passage. It really does it not? Christians should be the most acutely aware individuals of the eternity that lies within our hearts and our souls, and we can only find fulfillment in our sovereign and awesome God. He's making you and everything so beautiful in its time, in his own time. All good things, all bad things, all things are part of the plan. Trust in him and let go. It's okay. He's got it. He's God, and there's a reason why it's happening. I don't know everything that's occurring in your life, but there's a reason it's happening. He's got it. He's God. Ponder these things and ask yourself these things, and then when things do happen, respond in the way that God would have you to do. And that's something that I've had to learn how to do. You'll find that life becomes so much more meaningful, so much more beautiful. And you realize that there's a sovereign reason behind everything, that your life is a work of the Master. And for the lost, those that have not believed in Christ as their Savior and repented, I want to ask you something. What meaning does your life have? You might try to reason that you live for your family or that you live for being happy or finding pleasure, but one day those things end. And what will you be left with? Children grow up, parents die, spouses and partners pass away one way or another. Escapism can only go so far, and Solomon knew that better than anyone, and that didn't bring him any happiness. So, you're going to die taking nothing with you, just as you got here with nothing. And you might try and tell me that you believe in no eternity and no God, no next life, there's really no meaning or whatever else, but just as Alistair Begg kind of said nearly verbatim in his sermon on this, I want to tell you that the Bible knows something about yourself that you're not prepared to admit, and it's that you do believe in eternity. You know that God exists. In the deepest recesses of your heart and soul, you know that God exists. Atheism does not exist. Repression of the truth does, though. And nothing will ever come from that, save for desperately hoping somewhere in life you find contentment, only to find that nothing is permanent in this life except for the fact that nothing will bring you contentment. Nothing is ultimately fulfilling. So what profit do you have for all your labor without God? And what point is there without him? If you don't know the God who gives meaning, repent and believe in his Son, Christ Jesus. He's the only way to live a fulfilling and contented life. He's light and meaning. Without him, you're just stumbling around in darkness trying to grope for some sort of meaning somewhere. And God has commanded that all should repent and believe in his Son, who died as a sacrifice in order that we might be reconciled to an all-sovereign and eternal God who has a plan so big that we can't even possibly understand. I pray that you know him and that your life has meaning. We'll end there.